Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Justin Klee and Josh Cohen, the co-founders and co-chief executive officers of Amylyx Pharmaceuticals, who sat down at the recently concluded AAN annual meeting to discuss the pivotal PHOENIX study results and the decision behind pulling AMX0035, the most recently approved therapy for ALS, off market. The duo discussed the need for industry leaders to be transparent about data, even if it's not what they expect. In addition, the duo talked about the plans of AMX0035 in other tauopathies and the company's other investigational agent, AMX0114, an antisense oligonucleotide currently in development for ALS as well. Let's dive in.
So we're a mission-focused company at Amylyx, so we always try to think first and foremost, what is best for the patients we are serving, what is best for the community. So when we got the results, which unfortunately were that the drug did not meet its pre-specified primary outcome, nor the key secondary outcomes, that was what drove our decision. It was certainly shocking, coming off a positive phase two study that had been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, met its pre-specified primary outcome, trended on all the secondaries plus a post-hoc survival benefit. It was definitely very surprising. So we took some time going through the data, talking to various members of the community, and in the end, we felt that the results, the efficacy was sufficiently uncertain given these results, that we thought this was the best, outcome. Dr. Vanderberg gave a fantastic presentation, today. Dr. Vanderberg and Dr. Sabrina Paganoni co-chaired this study, we were excited to get the results out there, but it was those results that ultimately drove the decision.
Yeah, but I think something that was really important to us is that there are many, many people on the treatment, and, we just felt like it was unfair and frankly not our position to say, for people who felt like they were benefiting, they should be able to continue on treatment. That's up to them and their physician and, the person's family. So for people who were on treatment, we're using our free drug program to make sure that they can continue on treatment.
Let's talk a little bit about the PHOENIX study specifically. Obviously, it did not meet the primary and secondary endpoints, but not all studies are considered a failure and things of that sort. So what can we learn from the PHOENIX study? What positives can we take from the study? Just talk a little bit about the mindset right now going forward.
I think it's a critical question, and I think that what we can learn from the PHOENIX study will continue to learn from it. So I think the first is that we ran a really high-quality study, and something we're really proud of is that there's excellent ALS research that's done all over the world, and so the opportunity to run a trial in 12 countries using the same outcomes and very, very rigorously done, and a collaboration between TRICALS in Europe, NEALS in the United States. It's something we're really proud of, and we hope sets a good precedent for trials going forward. I would also say that it's an important opportunity to look at. We had a pretty clearly successful phase two, met its pre-specified primary outcome, showed a post-hoc survival difference, and now we have the phase three trial, which did not meet its primary outcome. And so why the difference between the two studies? And I think it speaks a lot to how much we still have to learn about ALS. And in some ways, we're in uncharted water. But I think that's where it's really important to do what I think we've always tried to do, which is bring all of the experts in, be transparent about the data. What can we learn about what this means for ALS, for ALS trials going forward? I think high level, our feeling is that we have made such progress in our understanding of the disease over the past 5 to 10 years. We're now starting to have these sort of test cases of, we have these promising treatment candidates, and now we want to see, do they work in the whole population? Do they work in certain parts of the population? How do we address different sources of variability within studies? And we think this will be a really nice data set to help the field in those regards.
Yeah, and I might just add too, there's still more to come in that regard too. As we shared, we'll be looking at several biomarkers. We'll be looking at, you know, those in relation to clinical outcomes. So there's a lot more, I think, to learn here. With our past study too, Centaur, we also donated that data to PROACT so that it would become, you know, open source data. I also think there's a constant need in ALS, since things are changing, to have modern natural history data, which, you know, the placebo groups and otherwise of trials can become. So I think there's a lot that can come of Phoenix. One other point that's been raised in ALS is a debate about how long trials should be. And one thing that's nice is there really have not been, in kind of the modern era of ALS in the last 10 or 15 years, most trials have been 24 weeks. This trial was 48 weeks. And so I think it also allows for a good data set to evaluate the pros and cons of those two designs. And thinking about Phoenix specifically, what we see compared to Centaur is going longer does mean more dropout, but it also means more total progression. So you maybe have a bigger window to show an effect. And, you know, the question of how those trade-offs play out, I think, is one, you know, we were at a recent conversation with the field as well, is one that will be, I think, continually debated. You know, do the pros outweigh the cons or not in terms of, you know, trial design of that length?
This may be a little bit of an early question, and I know you kind of touched upon it there for a second, but as we're kind of going through the data and what we're seeing, is there a possibility that this drug could have an effect on patients with ALS of less severe disease progression, or patients with certain types of genetic backgrounds? Obviously, you guys are still kind of parsing through things right now, but has there been any sort of lean any way towards those kind of things?
I'd say no lean. I mean, I think for us, I really appreciate your comments. Transparency is so important. I mean, we set out to run a study, the Phoenix study. We enrolled 664 participants. We followed them over 48 weeks duration. And, you know, the results were clear, which is the study did not meet its primary outcome. We hope we can continue to learn from that. And certainly there's a possibility that, you know, we find that there are particular groups of people who may indeed benefit. But that's not what this study was designed to show. This study was designed to show efficacy in the population we enrolled. And very sadly, it did not show efficacy. I do want to comment on one thing you said, too, from the Alzheimer's field. We are great admirers of what they've done. I think if you look at the development over the past 10, 15 years, really I give the leaders in that field so much credit. They kept refining trials. They kept refining the criteria. They kept following the science, addressing variability, realizing that they needed to go earlier and earlier. And now we're finally starting to see some, you know, remarkably successful treatments and trials. And I think that's a model for us in ALS and probably neurology generally. These are really hard diseases to address. The only way we're going to is if we, you know, keep following the science and, you know, keep at it.
Yeah, I'd just add to, you know, one other learning I think we take is the value of what you can measure, you know, in these diseases. You know, one of the things that's true across most of neurology, maybe with the exception of neuro-oncology, is that we can't look at the tissue we're most interested in a petri dish, right? We can't take a biopsy of, you know, of what we want to measure. And I think in ALS, one of the other things that's happened in the time since we started Centaur and then Phoenix is there's been more and more interest in markers of target engagement, in markers of neurodegeneration, et cetera. So you know, we are also working on an additional candidate, AMX-114, that should go to clinic before the end of the year, that targets calpain-2, which is one of the, you know, key markers in axonal degeneration. And I think one of the things we've taken from the Phoenix development plan as well is to really try to have markers that we can use both to select dose, to really refine, you know, duration of exposure, et cetera, which, you know, generally has not been the case in ALS. If you look through many of the past ALS trials, Centaur and Phoenix included, you know, we didn't necessarily have that clear marker that could tell us if we were engaging the target quite as hard as we'd like or otherwise. And I think as we continue to look at Phoenix, that's one of the things we will be looking for. Are there any markers that, you know, tell us a particular thing? But as Justin said, we have a statistical plan for a reason. We have a pre-specified analysis for a reason. Those are the things that we, you know, rest our weight on. You know, the other things are more for scientific interest and, you know, maybe future development and otherwise.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Justin and Josh to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on April 29th, the FDA approved Aquestive Therapeutics' diazepam buccal film, marketed as Libervant, for the treatment of pediatric patients with intermittent, stereotypic episodes of frequent seizure activity. Libervant, a buccal form of diazepam administered on the inside of the cheek, was approved for patients aged between 2 and 5 based on data from a crossover study of patients with refractory epilepsy. On the same day, the European Medicines Agency's Committee for Medicinal Products for Human Use recommended approval for a subcutaneous administration of ocrelizumab, the only marketed therapy to treat both progressive and relapsing forms of multiple sclerosis. Data supporting the use of subcutaneous ocrelizumab stems from the Phase 3 Ocarina 2 trial, a global randomized study that compared the pharmacokinetics of subcutaneous ocrelizumab with its intravenous infusion formulation, the formulation for which it was initially approved in. And finally, a day later, on April 30th, the FDA approved a new sprinkle formulation for Neurocrine Biosciences' valbenazine, an approved therapy for patients with tardive dyskinesia or chorea associated with Huntington disease. Valbenazine is currently available as the only single capsule, once daily treatment option with no complex titration for adults with tardive dyskinesia and the treatment of chorea associated with Huntington's. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Justin and Josh.
I know we've talked a little bit in the past, especially recently, about AMX and what else it can do. So talk a little bit about some of the overall profile of AMX and where else it can be of benefit, considering obviously we're trying to look past the Phoenix study right now.
Absolutely. Well, I think the key in drug development is always matching the mechanism of the drug to the mechanism of the disease. And, I think we still very much believe that the pathways that we're engaging here, being endoplasmic reticulum stress and mitochondrial dysfunction, are important drivers across multiple diseases. First, we have an ongoing study in PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy, enormous unmet need. I'm sure I don't need to tell your audience that. PSP, there's very clear implications of ER stress and mitochondrial dysfunction. Also, it's very clearly a tau-driven neurodegenerative disease. We ran a very small Alzheimer's study several years ago and showed very significant reductions in CSF of both total tau and phospho-tau-181. So I think between the mechanism and the biomarker engagement, we're excited about the prospects in PSP, and that study's currently enrolling. We also just recently announced interim data on AMX35 in Wolfram syndrome. Wolfram syndrome is another unmet need. It's a largely monogenic disease. It's caused by mutations in WFS1. It causes cell dysfunction and death starting in beta cells, so it appears like type 1 diabetes, but then it becomes a neurodegenerative disease. So sadly, kids get vision loss and then hearing loss, ataxia, and then tend to pass away in their late 20s. So it's a really tough disease. Our interim data is very encouraging. So 8 participants, 24 weeks dosing, but in a progressive disease, we're seeing in most participants stabilization or even improvement across pancreatic functioning as measured by C-peptide, a number of other endocrine function measures, as well as some of the other organ systems like visual acuity. We're seeing signs of stabilization or improvement. So I think it speaks to, again, the drug activity is very clear here. It's about matching the drug activity to the mechanism of disease. So again, it speaks to the overall point that we have to keep following the science, and we're very optimistic that we'll have opportunities to keep helping people who really need it.
Actually, one last question for you guys. I know you touched upon your other investigational agent. Can you talk a little bit about, what is it, AMX-014, am I correct?
114, yes.
114, that's correct. Can you talk a little bit about the mechanism of action of that and just some of the early, things with it?
AMX-114 targets calpain 2. And so calpain 2 is one of these targets that's been studied extensively. You go through the literature, quite literally hundreds, maybe even thousands of papers on calpain 2, and the interest of it has mainly been around the basic science of Wallerian degeneration, the process by which axons degenerate and die upon injury or stress. And calpain is considered kind of the executioner of Wallerian degeneration. The protein gets activated by calcium influx, which can happen a number of ways. If you have glutamate excitotoxicity, the NMDA receptor is a calcium channel. If you have ER stress, you have calcium flowing out of the ER. The mitochondria is a calcium buffer. So there's a lot of ways for this protein to get activated and then execute Wallerian degeneration. I think one of the other really interesting things about calpain is it's linked to neurofilament light. So there's been lots of interesting work recently, including from Dr. Jerry Shaw, that showed that when we're measuring neurofilament light in the CSF or plasma, there's almost no, or in his case, in his publications, no full-length protein. The protein is all cleaved into fragments that the antibody is picking up. So the question arises, what's cleaving it? He's done some work, and there's been some work in the literature that the protease cleaving it may be calpain 2. And so I think all of those are kind of connected points of interest. The compound, we've also used it in various preclinical models. We've seen neurofilament reduction preclinically. We've seen neuronal rescue in TDP43 models and otherwise. All of this kind of leads to our excitement. The other thing is it's nice working with a protease. Calpain 2 is a protease. So when we're clinical, there are many known proteins that calpain 2 breaks down. And many of those protein fragments show up in the CSF or plasma. So you can see very clearly if you're engaging your target as well as you hope, because those fragments should decrease or disappear. And similarly, I think with neurofilament, we hope to see, an effect there, given, again, that it is a protease that cleaves neurofilament and maybe cleaving neurofilament to, kind of have these antibody-positive fragments that, may be what we're detecting in these diseases.
In terms of next steps for AMX-114, our calpain 2 ASO, so we hope to be enrolling participants in our multiple ascending dose trial later this year. We're very eager to see if that may be a promising new treatment candidate for people with ALS.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.